From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
While restaurants and markets in various parts of the country reopen following the shutdown for the coronavirus, experts from the Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Food Program briefed journalists in New York on the state of food security around the world, this following the release of the UN Secretary General's policy brief on the impact of the pandemic on food security and nutrition. Although the pandemic could push nearly 50 million more people into extreme poverty, these and other potentially dire impacts of the crisis could be avoided with immediate action to shore up global food security. The press conference was held in New York on Tuesday by Maximo Torero Cohen with the Food and Agriculture Organization and Arif Hussein with the World Food Program. We bring you as much of that as time will allow.
We'll go to questions from the press. If there are any, please signal to me if anyone in the press has a question.
I have a question.
All right, go right ahead.
My question is, does the UN realize really the value of bees for nutrition and how they help the economy, and also with the virus, the importance of the bees and the honey they produce? And a lot of the developing countries could have beehives. They're not expensive. You just need a queen bee and a few other bees cooperating. You can sell the honey for the economy, but also for the local people. It's much healthier than sugar, and particularly with the virus, with people drinking a lot of tea. And I feel that there was a Bee Day at the UN, and it was very important. It was sponsored by Slovenia, and I believe by Nepal, and I know that Singapore is very involved in the breeding of these bees. I think it's important because it's an easy way to help the in poverty and a way to sell the honey. It brings a big price.
Mr. Torero, do you wish to respond? Thanks. Mr. Torero.
Can you hear me well?
Yes.
Okay, so the bees are essential, and FAO gives a huge importance to them. For centuries, they're the hardest working creatures on the planet, and they have benefited people, plants, and the environment. They carry pollen from one flower to another, so pollinization is one of the major roles, but as you mentioned, also they produce honey, which has significant micronutrients and are important complements in what we call healthy diets. So for sure, outside of their job of pollinators, which is crucial for us to have food, we need pollinization. What they produce through honey is an essential element that we need to take into account in what we refer as healthy diets, which are, of course, based on what locally is available or what you can, the different elements of food that you can bring into your diet. But yes, they play a crucial role, and the Bee Day is the 20th of May.
Yeah, great. Are there any further questions? If there are no further questions for Mr. Torero, we will go to our next speaker, the chief economist at the World Food Program, Arif Hussein. Mr. Hussein, are you online?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thanks very much. Thanks very much for joining. Please proceed.
Okay, so let me stop, or let me start where Massimo stopped. I think it's quite clear that COVID is coming at a situation which was already quite bad. We talk about acute hunger. 4 years ago, we had 80 million people in acute hunger. At the end of 2019, we had 135 million people in acute hunger. So COVID is compounding already a bad situation to begin with. For us, what is really, really important is to make sure that we are able to reach people who are in worst possible states even before COVID came. What I mean by that is that of this 135 million people who are in acute hunger, about 30 million of those are already in emergencies. And these people, I mean, they are essentially those who are caught in conflict, whether it be in Yemen, whether it be in Syria, in South Sudan, in Northeast Nigeria, in Burkina Faso, a whole bunch of countries. And what we need to make sure is that we are able to reach them regardless of anything, including COVID. Because if we don't, they end up paying the ultimate price. The second thing which is really important right now is that we understand that food insecurity, hunger was there because there are some root causes. It is conflict. It is still the biggest reason why most people are going hungry. It is climate shocks. It is economic marginalization. It is all of those together. And then on top of that, COVID. So at the moment, we are saying about 265 million people who are in acute hunger. What going forward in terms of our recommendations, like the SG said, like the Secretary General said, what is really important is to save lives and also protect livelihoods. We are working towards getting, in a given year, last year, as the World Food Program, we assisted about close to 100 million people. This was through food. This was through cash to about 28 million people. It was about school meals to about 18 million children. It was about nutrition for mother and child for about 17 million children. We need to continue this. But we need to not only continue this, but actually increase it. The second thing is that all that we are doing, that is a drop in the bucket, given the magnitude of the problem with which we are dealing right now. That's where the importance of social protection, safety nets, working with the governments, creating the fiscal space in these governments so they can implement their own safety net programs in agencies like ours who have the experience, whether it was through Ebola or through large-scale social protection programs, could assist. The third thing, I think what is really important, I think Massimo alluded to that as well, is the agricultural sector. We have ample stocks as we speak, but having ample stocks right now is no guarantee that we will have ample stocks next season, next year, which means that we need to treat the agricultural sector as an essential sector. Farmers must be able to go to the fields to plant, to harvest. Seeds must come to them. Fertilizer must come to them, because if it doesn't happen for any reason, we're going to have a bigger problem next year. So these are some of the things where we are pushing and pushing hard to make sure that we are, till we get to a stage where there is an affordable treatment for everybody around the world, we save lives and we protect livelihoods. Last thing I wanted to say was, we are worried about a few places in the world, especially the southern hemisphere, especially places in southern Africa, where you are starting out extreme poverty. You're starting out with undernourishment. You have had history of HIV/AIDS. You have had history of TB. You have had successive climatic shocks. And the health sectors don't work there quite well either. So that creates a cocktail with which we need to be ready. Otherwise, we will see things which at least I don't want to see. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much, Mr. Hussein. Those of you who are still in this virtual room, I can't see any hands raised, and I don't see any questions in chat. So please let me know if any of you have any questions.
I would like to talk.
Oh, yeah.
I know some of my viewpoints points may be a bit exotic, but I've been studying with this food. And now, when I went to Japan and China, they gave me fried locusts as a delicacy. I'm wondering why, with the total terrible locust infestation now, they can't be also somehow or other prepared for nutrition.
Thanks.
That's a very interesting question. I mean, you know, there are parts of the world where people do get protein from different insects. But I think the situation sometimes is time sensitive. People are not used to, so they need to have the time to adapt to something which they're going to do. And here, if you're short of something, that is time. So if you have never tried anything of a particular type, and frankly, nobody is giving it to you in that sense, bringing it to you and saying, here, try it or test it or anything of that sort, because of many logistical issues, cultural issues, all of the above, it's very difficult. So these are the things which we need to think about when we are out of crisis. This to me is about preparedness of crisis. This is about, okay, how can we increase our food supply? How can we bring in protein? How can we do other things, but not to try it during the emergency, but start before? It is almost like emergency preparedness than emergency action. But there are many, many things we can do. And I think if there is one lesson we can learn from this crisis, is to be better prepared for the next one, because believe me, there will be a next one.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have a question from Toby Burns from NHK. Toby.
Thanks very much, Farhan. A question for both of our panelists. Sometimes with reporting on food statistics, it's a little bit difficult because the most efficient way to grade the scenarios is in terms of different bars, like a level one is, and then level two is famine, and three is acute insecurity. But I'm just wondering if you might be able, in the sake for the sake of the clarity of writing about your findings, if we should be focusing on one specific number that you discussed today, like 265 million, or just a little help with the communications aspect of this to get the fundamental impact of what you're trying to say. Thank you very much.
If I can, I would say that basically we have a IPC integrated phase classification scale, basically, which is five phases, if you will. So phase one is you're okay. Phase two is you're stressed. Phase three is you're in the crisis. Phase four is you're in emergency. And phase five is catastrophe or famine. So when we are doing these numbers and we talk about acute hunger, especially the out of this 265, there are 135 million. That is people who are already in crisis or worse situation. So phase three and above. And that, then the second distinction comes between what is chronic and what is acute. The chronic is something where you go to bed every night the same way. That's your life. You're hungry not because a particular shock happened. You're just hungry. And then comes the acute part where, frankly, you were okay. Everything was fine. And then the shock happened. Now, that shock could be war, like we see. That could be a drought. That could be a landslide. That could be an earthquake. All kinds of different shocks. And that's what we call acute. So right now, what you have is two things. One, you have acute number of people hurting over the last 4 years, going consistently up. That was what I was saying, 80 million to 135 million. Then you have COVID, which is affecting some of those same people, but it is also affecting other people who were already before that, they were okay. So think about people in the informal sector. Think about people in the service sector. Think about manufacturing, Bangladesh, garment industry. Think about Kenya tourism. You know, these are the people then, because they are in lockdowns or they've lost their jobs because tourism isn't going anywhere or remittances are not coming. Before, with remittances, they were fine, but now they're not. So this is the addition of that, this, you know, and by the way, this is a projection of 130. So 135, which we know till end of 2019, plus a projection of 130, which is changing as things will open and other things will happen, gives you the 265. I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, that was really helpful. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Torero, do you also have anything to say to Toby's question?
Only one comment. The IPC classification that was referred to, right now a country is in food crisis if it is in IPC 3 or higher, okay? Now, what is the risk today? The risk is that the level 5 is the situation of famine. So basically what you need to avoid, what we want to avoid, is countries which are in IPC 3 or 4 to move to 5. That's the first element. Because once they move to 5, there is no way back. That's what I call the knockout, okay? So essentially, these people are in famine situation. Now, the problem is that we also have a significant amount of people in IPC 2. And that's the risk, that the probability of people in IPC 2 will move into IPC 3 and therefore will move into the food crisis. So it's very important to be very careful with the numbers, but the situation is extremely, extremely vulnerable right now. In addition to that, we measure the effects of poverty. And there are several simulations in terms of the impact of extreme poverty, people moving into extreme poverty. Initially, the World Bank projected that 55 million people were moving into extreme poverty. Other centers have projected around 130 million people moving into extreme poverty. So the numbers vary a lot, and it depends on what we are going to face in terms of recession or GDP decline. Today, the World Bank has published that the outlook for GDP decline is 5.2%. With that outlook of GDP decline, that will imply a significant increase in food insecurity, in undernourishment in the world. Just to give you an idea, 5% decline in GDP growth will imply around 38 million people moving into undernourishment. A 10% GDP decline will imply around 80 million people moving into undernourishment only for net food importing countries. If we include all the countries of the world, we are talking of around 120 million people moving into undernourishment, which is an addition to the IPC classification. So again, we need to look at this very carefully, because we need to be very careful with numbers. People get shocked by big numbers, but the conclusion is that we are in a pretty complex situation, and the figures that we are observing in terms of the recession are extremely high, and we need to act quickly to be able to minimize that potential migration from IPC 2 to IPC 3, or especially the potential migration from IPC 3, 4 to 5, which is what we don't want to happen.
Thanks very much. I have a question now from Ibtisam Azam. Ibtisam, please unmute your mic.
Hi, Farhan. Thank you. So I have a few questions also to clarify something. So the number 820 million people suffering from hunger, could you please say where, in which areas, and is it only mainly in countries that suffer from war and climate, acute climate changes? And the additional number that you have in the report, the 49 million people, is this only this year added to this 820 million? And then, is it possible when we talk about acute hunger and hunger and the differences, what does it mean for the daily life of people? Does that mean that they are food insecure, they can't find their next meal, If you could just clarify these things. And the last thing is about Yemen and the situation they are facing there. If you could talk more about the problems there, given the fact that the UN did not get enough money for the aid they were hoping to get. Thank you.
So let me start with, so this 821 million, this is acute hunger. So this includes India, this includes other countries where there is chronic poverty and chronic hunger. If you took this 821 million, you would see that about 60% of these people live in conflict affected areas. So it is a mix. Now, what is quite interesting is that if you look at the acute hunger, this is what I was talking about, 135 million. 77 million people of those are affected by conflict. 34 million from climate shocks. 24 million from economic shocks. And by the way, it's never one. It is a combination of everything. Right? But climate conflict, the biggest, then climate, then economic shocks, and usually a cocktail. Now, when you look at the regions of those, and I'm talking acute hunger, what you will find is that 73 million of those 135 million are in Africa, 43 million in Middle East, in Asia, 18 million in Latin America and the Caribbean. So this is the distribution of those people. It gets even worse because then you have about 49 million wasted children. Okay, and vast majority of those are in conflict affected areas. And then you have about not quite 150. But slightly less than 150, I think it's 147 million or something like that, stunted children. Still, vast majority of those in conflict areas. This is why it is so important to deal with the root causes. Root causes of hunger. COVID is highlighting already a bad situation. It is just compounding it. I think that's really important to note. For us, you asked about Yemen. We assist about 12, 13 million people every single month in Yemen. And that's what needs to happen. Because if you look at just food insecurity numbers, it's close to 20 million. If we don't have enough resources, we are not able to do this. And this is why we talk about these 30 million, the vast majority of those 30 million people are in Yemen. I will give you another example, which is Syria. In Syria, the big problem right now is the currency there is literally tanking. Officially, some say it's 435, others say it would be 700. In the market, it's over 3,000 billion pounds to a dollar. And the impact of the Lebanese crisis on Syria is immense. The banking crisis in Lebanon on Syria is immense. So 9 years of war, losing jobs, currency tanking, inflation up the roof. I was just doing numbers. Today in Syria, the prices of a regular food basket are 16 times higher than they were pre-crisis. So these are the realities, and these are the people who then are in the emergency phase, IPC phase four. And there's not a big jump. This is what Massimo was saying, from phase four to phase five. And frankly, if you get to phase five, you've already failed, because famine means people have already died. Famine means that children have already suffered, and famine means that 20% of the population is already starving. Three conditions must come together for us to declare a famine. So it is not about saying, okay, let's act because there is a famine. It is about let's act so there is not a famine. And we need to be very clear that we understand that distinction. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mr. Hussein. Mr. Torero, do you have anything to say about Hassan's question?
Yes. First, on the definitions, which I think is really important to have them very clear so that we don't have a confusion. And there are two concepts that we are using. One is acute food insecurity, which is any manifestation of food insecurity at a specific point in time of a severity that threatens life, livelihoods, or both, regardless of the causes, context, or duration. So it's a manifestation. So, for example, the major drivers of acute food insecurity will be conflict, weather shocks, slowdowns, what we are facing today with the recession, and climatological. But then the other concept, which is the 821 million that you were referring, is what Arif mentioned, is the chronic food insecurity. And chronic food insecurity is a long-term or persistent inability to meet dietary energy requirements, which will last for significant level of periods of a time during the year. And this is what FAO calls undernourishment, and that's our indicator, it is indicator POU. So the 821 million is chronic food insecurity or POU or undernourishment. While acute food insecurity is what is reported in the Global Food Crisis report, which is basically this manifestation of food insecurity. So that's why the difference and why the numbers are different. Now, if we said that and we refer to the number that you refer, the 49 million or the 50 million, this is the number of people moving into extreme poverty as defined by the World Bank with the poverty line of extreme poverty. And what the World Bank is saying is that around 50 million of people will be moving into extreme poverty, okay? Which it correlates with the measure of acute food insecurity and chronic, but it's not a one-to-one correlation. That's why the numbers are different. Now, these 50 million people is a number that is over the year, what they are expecting to be over the year. And what we need to be clear is that a person can move, if you have a job today and you lose your job today, that person today doesn't have an income. So today that person could be classified as a person that is moving into extreme poverty. But that will change tomorrow if you get a job, which the probability is potentially high, which is different to what the bank is predicting, which is basically during that year, you will be classified as extreme poor because you won't be able to get the minimum income you need to be able to pass that line of extreme poverty. So three different concepts: acute food insecurity, which is food insecurity at a specific point in time and severity; chronic food insecurity, which is a long-term persistent inability to meet dietary energy requirements; and the last one is the point of extreme poverty, which is of a basket of food and for the period of a year. So that is essentially the three definitions that we work with.
Thank you very much. I don't see any further hands up, but one reporter did send a question in by text. I think you've already dealt with this, but hold on, please. Hold on, please. You can have this after. Deepak Arora from the Tribune Online has asked about any other hotspots in the world regarding food insecurity. I know that you've touched on this with Ibtisam's question, but if you have anything to add, either of you, please go ahead.
Look, what we are facing because of the levels of unemployment that we're facing in the world, even imagine in developed countries, we're having rates of unemployment of 20%. In developing countries where most of the economy is informal, 60 or 70% of the economy is informal, with the lockdowns, all these people lose their activity, their economic activity. And all those people, basically, if they didn't have savings, will move into a situation of food insecurity. And this will create significantly new hotspots in new areas. Of course, some of them will be able to reactivate their economies. But the ones that who cannot go back immediately into a job because small businesses, informal businesses have been closing and so on and so forth, those are the areas where we believe new hotspots will appear.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.